Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we focus in on the cultural factors connected to healthy psychology in men and women with returning guest Dr. Paul Dobransky. But let's look at some of the stories in other news. Here's a story by Michael Snyder. Agenda 21 being rammed down the throats of local communities all over America. This is a story also that we are going to look deep into in the coming weeks. Those that promote the philosophy underlying Agenda 21 believe that human activity must be managed and that letting people make their own decisions is destructive and dangerous. Sadly, the principles behind Agenda 21 are being rammed down the throats of local communities all over America, and most of the people living in those communities don't even realize it. How is this being done? Well, after Agenda 21 was adopted, an international organization known as the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives, known as ICLEI, was established to help implement the goals of Agenda 21 in local communities. One thing they learned very quickly was that the Agenda 21 label was a red flag for a lot of people. It tended to create quite a bit of opposition on the local level. As they try to implement their goals, they very rarely use the term Agenda 21 anymore. Instead, they use much more harmless-sounding labels such as smart growth, comprehensive land use planning, and especially sustainable development. I know we've covered this a lot on the show, but this is a critical part of the big plan here in North America, something to watch as it begins to affect local communities. And again, that will be one of the shows coming up to look deep into an individual's experience. Early last summer, Dr. Paul Dobransky joined us live in the studio to talk about his visual system to understand and begin to utilize a healthy human boundary. He says your identity in life depends upon learning about boundaries. It's also connected to learning how to be free from stress and how to command respect. We go in a different direction today and look at the effects of pervasive social media for young people and the psychology of men in context of the recent mass shootings. Late last week, the calls for stricter gun control laws have since dominated the mainstream media narrative, but as many listeners know, there is a deeper systemic problem that transcends guns and even race. It is connected to men's psychology, according to our returning guest, Dr. Paul Dobransky. Dr. Paul points out that gunmen are always male, and that they rarely have a woman or romantic interest, and they have work problems or no job at all. What cultural factors have contributed to these psychological states in young men, whether they are naturally or unnaturally induced? Is there more of a weakness or vulnerability to exploit within human males, or is this a cultural phenomenon? Has society forsaken the special considerations critical for the development of men and their psychology in these two areas of relationships and work? There are other factors, such as that the 14 gunmen of the recent shootings were taking or withdrawing from psychiatric drugs, such as Prozac, Zoloft, Trazodone, or Xanax. Nearly half of the shooters were seeing either a psychiatrist or psychologist. Dr. Paul, as many know him as, is a psychiatrist, author, speaker, and runs the websites womenshappiness.com and menspsychology.com. He conducts seminars on dating and relationships with men and women. His system, called MindOS, is the starting point for most of his clients, and it covers a lot of material. But today, we focus in on what contributes to overwhelming stress in young people and the cultural factors connected to healthy psychology in men and women. Dr. Paul Dobransky, welcome back to In Other News.
Thank you.
Well, it's good to have you back. Dr. Paul, you were in Colorado during the Columbine shooting, and you worked as a therapist right after the shooting. So this recent Connecticut shooting has a significant impact on you.
Yeah, it does. Columbine was, you know, the first of all these escalating, you know, more recent mass shooting events like this, and it caused us all to start to wonder about the sociology and the psychology of what could be behind this. One of the things I noticed, I went in the day after I worked locally for the county at that time, and I went in the day after to be available and found not a lot of people wanted to talk about it. So one of the things I want to say at the outset here is all of this regarding Connecticut is so recent, so raw, and it's time for grief and anger. So it's understandable if this isn't a topic people may want to think about right now or talk about right now. But I think there are things to do to eventually start to feel better about it, whether you're directly affected or indirectly affected by it. Surely it affects the entire community and the entire nation. Some of the things about violence that would make sense for us to understand at the get-go so that we don't get overly worried all the time. Is it still safe to send kids to school at all? This sort of thing. It is important for us to remember that events like this are indeed rare. They're still rare, but horrible, and have a deep, heavy impact, as I said, on the whole community and on the nation. But they are rare. Now, if we were to look at getting, you know, into a grief process and feeling helpless and eventually wanting to come out of it and do something, you know, there's a call for us to do something about this. How could we categorize what our possible actions could be to try to be preventative of this sort of thing in the future?
What area would people start? There are these calls for gun control. The reality is that more children drown in pools.
Yeah.
And that may not necessarily stop these particular violent rampages. However,
yeah. Well, I think each individual is going to have their own take on what they think ought to be done, but maybe some ground rules about how to think about it, how to divide up the possibilities for what could we do. One way is to think about external measures, external controls, like gun control is an example of that. It's a big external, like a national policy kind of measure to consider. The other end of the spectrum would be education, teaching. What can you teach kids in the classroom that might be preventative, that they could take into their psychology and how they conduct themselves? So there's what's external and there's what's internal. Do we want to try for internal change in kids and all of us and how we think and how we react to violence? Or do we want to have these external measures placed on things? When I heard about a lot of the gun control talk, for some reason, I immediately thought of England. And I was like, well, they don't have guns there publicly. They seem to get along okay. But, you know, depending on what your personal beliefs are about the right to carry arms and this sort of thing, you'll make up your own decision about that. Another feature, though, that we have to consider is, you know, violence is known to have preconditions. It's one of these things where if somebody, you know, loses it and snaps, then after the fact we say, oh, well, it's no wonder because they had these preconditions in place. But the problem is violence in a specific individual can't be predicted ahead of time in terms of when, where, how, or why. And that's because something triggers them. So there's a difference between a precondition for violence and a trigger of it. For example, what if a teen boy had the preconditions for violence? Some of them would be things like mental illness, as you've mentioned. Certain mental illnesses, there's a higher possibility regarding. Another would be substance abuse. Okay. Another big one would be prior violence. Prior violence is a big predictor or precondition for future violence. But even then, we wouldn't know what would the exact trigger eventually be and when would it happen. That's the stuff of that film Minority Report.
in an individual, it's hard to predict. Even though there was an article about government agencies monitoring social media to be able to predict another one of these shooting rampages. But preconditions exist, such as the mental illness, substance abuse, prior violence. It's still unpredictable in terms of what triggers
the event. Like, what is the trigger? Mm-hmm. And the trigger, what if the trigger is something random, like mom grounds him? You know, you're grounded. And then that's the trigger. So from there, what do we do? Do we impose external measures on, you know, no parent may ground their children because grounding that particular child was a trigger? We can't do that.
Can you talk a little bit about, is it cultural in a wider view?
Well, you know, let's think logically about a few of these things. You know, what's in common with most of these horrific events? You know, they're almost always male. A significant percent of the time, there's something to do with mental illness going on, either undertreated or there was something wrong with medications, or it was a very difficult illness, or the person wasn't plugged in enough to mental health systems, or there wasn't enough support. But there was something to do with mental illness oftentimes. But then there are two other features. If you think about them logically, if we're talking about males, you know, how often have you heard of a male who has a lot of love in his life? And has a solid romantic relationship that goes well, who loses it?
Not often.
It's a major part of life. It's something to live for. It's a core to your being that you are in a wonderful love relationship that's solid, like a solid marriage, for example. Mm-hmm. On the other end of the spectrum, say the man is single, you know, doesn't have a loving romantic relationship, but he has a very solid job and a real mission for his life and draws a lot of purpose from that and a solid sense of identity and who he is. How often have you heard of that guy losing it? You know, not so often.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these two, you might just call them social factors or social variables, psychosocial features, are pretty powerful for giving, you know, in this case, a male, a solid sense of identity, purpose, and feeling good about who he is. Somebody who would naturally feel like doing good in the world, as opposed to being angry, hostile, or impulsive.
It takes a lot of work to build those things in your life, especially as a man.
Mm-hmm.
And these gunmen are usually young.
Yes.
And they may be seeing, dating a girl or have a girlfriend. But as far as a career or a purposeful career with meaning to his identity, that takes a while to build.
I don't necessarily mean the externals, like, you know, what somebody's salary is or something like this. I mean a sense of this is who I am. It might be that he loves music. The boy loves playing guitar, and that's his thing. That's what he's good at. Or he feels a sense of pride in something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the teen years, it could be more like a hobby, something that could become a career eventually.
But when these two things are gone, what happens?
Well, when those two things are gone, those two things are pretty strong drivers of feeling of a sense of vitality, a sense of being alive and excited to be alive, a sense of, I guess the word would be passion for life, excited to wake up in the morning. When you have love and work. In fact, I think Freud said mental health is the capacity to work and the capacity to love. Okay, so we're not just talking about men in terms of, you know, work being good for your life and love being good for your life. But in this particular case, We're talking about, you know, what are the unique ways that males find love, find romance, learn about it, develop skill to do well, and in career.
Yeah, I want to remind listeners we're speaking with Dr. Paul Dobransky. He's an author and a lecturer, and he is a psychiatrist. And he had written a book also about male archetypes. Do you look at some of these problematic issues within men's psychology in terms of the male archetypes?
You mean Jungianism?
In your book, yes.
Well, I'm not a Jungian psychologist per se, but I think there's a lot of value in the various schools of psychology. And so I think when people talk about archetypes and Jungian psychology, there's a lot of potential usefulness to that in terms of explaining the unconscious. You know, what is the structure of the human unconscious? And Jung dealt a lot with that. And I think there's a lot to ancient mythology that goes a long way to explain. For example, when you hear stories from ancient Greek literature about male gods and female goddesses and all the dramas that go on between them, there are a lot of kind of life lessons in those ancient mythologies that I think are a commentary on what is it to be masculine, what is it to be feminine, what are the unique ways that men think and women think, and we don't think exactly alike, clearly. I think that's the usefulness there of archetypes, explaining what is masculinity and what is femininity.
I understand.
And what is the unconscious?
And what is the unconscious? Well, these young people are living at a time where information is at their fingertips, mm-hmm. at a speed that may be too much for brains to process. And could you talk about what is going on inside the brain that is processing this information, good and bad, that may affect the psychology of that young person?
Well, sure. I think, one way of looking at it, you know, many are familiar with the work of author Dan Goleman, who wrote Emotional Intelligence so long ago. And he's a very good author at explaining connections in brain anatomy, what the different working parts do in the brain. And I kind of like one of his ways of talking about the emotional circuitry of the brain when he talks about the amygdala as being kind of like an alarm bell of the brain, a center of anxiety, okay, developing anxiety. And anxiety drives us to do impulsive things. You know, if we're just overloaded with anxiety, it drives us to do action. Undirected action is, by definition, impulsiveness. So as we all develop, you know, from child into adulthood, over time, we learn how to develop a stress tolerance and how to manage our own anxiety as we go through the teen years. And we learn how to put the brakes on, you know, impulsive drives to get angry, to get in a fist fight, to lash out at people, to overreact to things. There are two, you might call them, you know, cortical functions or executive functions, or what psychiatrists call them, that parallel maturity. One of them commonly is called observing ego, which just means the ability to be self-aware, socially aware, at the steering wheel of your behavior, so to speak. And it's the human function that gets encouraged when a teacher says something like, hey, take a time out. Take a time out. It's so that you can think and wake up and pay attention to what's really happening, and therefore then make the right decisions, make wise decisions, mature decisions. So observing ego is one psychological skill of maturity, if you will, that it can take us all, you know, some time to learn how to use. The second is boundaries, which we've talked about before.
Right. That was the topic of the whole show that we did in June, yeah. Live on the air.
Yeah. These two things, observing ego and boundaries, are like brakes on your impulsive behavior. Well, the drives and tendency to be impulsive, you might say, is instinctual. So we all have instincts. There's an animal area to our brain. There's an animal area to our mind. We hear a loud booming noise and we duck or startle or we turn around and look, where's that coming from? That's a reflex. So clearly we have animal reflexes and those have kept us alive as a species throughout the ages. But when these reflexes go unchecked, unfiltered, you know, undirected, that's when bad things happen. So back to Dan Goleman. When he talks about how this area of the brain, the amygdala, and this emotional circuitry of anxiety is very rapid, it needs to be rapid because ultimately it's designed to save our lives. When we hear a loud crash and we turn and look, that might save our lives. To dive out of the way of a speeding car or run from a large dog that's chasing us. We need these survival reflexes, fight or flight, right? But in between an instinctual response and making slow, wise decisions, a lot of processing needs to go on higher up in the brain, in the cerebral cortex. And that area is slow compared to the amygdala and this emotional circuitry. So enter the internet and enter text messaging and emails and Facebook and gossip, the social peer groups that teens have to navigate to find their way into belonging to some group. And they get dependent on Facebook and they get dependent on technology. It's their mode of communication instead of face-to-face once a day, and then you go home from school at the end of the day, and you get some downtime to process what happened at school that day. Mm-hmm. Now it's 24/7 because we're all wired all the time, you see, so it never stops. And then back to violence, you know, I think there are some sociological similarities between cases like these mass shootings and some of these other cases that involve suicide, gossip leading to suicide, you know, kids gossiping about each other on Facebook, you know, and then, you know, teen girl kills herself over it. Happens again and again and again. You Google search it and there are just more and more of these all the time. Cyberbullying.
Cyberbullying. Mm-hmm. This is men and women. I know we really focused in on discussing men's psychology because that's one of your strengths, but mm-hmm. this is both men and women here.
Sure. Yes.
With the social peer groups and social media. Mm-hmm. And you pointed out they can't get away from it. Years ago when I was going to school and you were going to school, yeah, we could just go home, close the door, and turn on the radio or watch TV or something. And we were unplugged from the peer group at high school or around us. Can't do that anymore as much.
Right.
You can turn off your cell phone or not go to the computer. Why isn't that such an option anymore?
Well, I think, you know, because more and more we get so dependent on the technology, we can't do without it. I almost don't remember the day when you had a landline with a, you know, plastic cord to the wall. And if you were going to ask somebody out on a date, you had to be at home and pick up your phone. But, you know, we're dependent on the technology. And there's a great need for belonging, you know, when we're young. We're trying to figure out what group do we fit in. There's some relevance there, you know, to the profiles of some of these mass shooters, too. The Virginia Tech one, I remember in particular, some of the, you know, painful experiences that young man went through being this total loner and culturally as well, just not accepted. So, you know, back to what could we possibly do about all this? Well, the very first step would be to, after taking good care of ourselves and going through a grief process, it would be to educate, to learn and be aware that these factors are going on and can create pain in young people and bullying is relevant as well. You know, stopping bullying, teaching kids boundaries, teaching them observing ego, to think before you act, and to have a sense of, you know, autonomy and your rights, that nobody has the right to bully you.
This goes to the second part of the teaching and going internal, mm-hmm. because the bullying and gossip isn't like it was when we were growing up now. Its impact has much more profound effects, mm-hmm. negative effects, not only on the brain, because of the speed at which this information travels to young people now. It's different. But these young people still have the same wiring to process this information, and it's hurting them.
Yeah, yeah. It's a... there are other psychological effects, too, of the internet and telecommunications. You know, one of those would be the concept called projection. Projection is where our minds have a natural tendency to want to finish incomplete stories. When we have partial information on something, for example, a classic one is, you're in the kitchen of your house, you know you've left the living room windows open, and it's a dark and stormy night. Suddenly you hear a crash coming from the living room. What happened?
The wind blew the lamp over.
Or there's a burglar, or any number of things. You're projecting, you're finishing the story that has incomplete information to begin with. Well, we can never have complete information about each other without meeting face-to-face. It's all rumor to a degree when we're talking about text information. When we talk to each other, and especially about each other, it's incomplete. So it would be easy to kind of get seduced into thinking that everything you read in text form is accurate or true. So all the more powerful then is cyberbullying, you know, because how real are these stories about people? And that's where you hear about teens offing themselves because of, you know, rumors and gossip getting spread about them.
So it becomes everything to them.
Yeah.
So teaching, as you pointed out, about the impact of bullying online and gossiping online. You also described the impact in the thalamus of that level of negativity. Can you describe that a little bit?
Yeah, yeah. There were, you know, after Columbine, there was a lot of research that went on in this area, and there's some really interesting research articles about it. And some mention was made of a brain structure called the thalamus and how it works. You know, in short, there are pain fibers from the body that radiate up into it. And it's part of how you know, oh, I'm in physical pain. There's some kind of damage going on to my body. I've broken my leg, or I have arthritis, or whatever it is. Goes up into the thalamus, the pain fibers. But there are also emotional circuitry connections going into the thalamus as well. Some of the researchers about violence after Columbine were studying, you know, the effect of gossip and bullying and the power of words to hurt each other, the power of words to hurt each other. And when you think about the thalamus in this way, if there is emotional circuitry that enter it and physical pain circuitry that enters it, and then from there it's like a relay station that sends the information higher into the cerebral cortex, where you finally come to the conscious realization, oh, I've hurt my leg, or oh, that comment that person just said really hurts. So to the higher brain, or to the cortex, an insult is no different from a punch to the face.
It registers as
it
a physical
hurts.
Pain.
Yes. It's not like a pain in a physical location, but it is pain. And if we believe it is wrong to inflict pain on other people, how much difference is gossip and insults and hate speech from a physical attack.
Our guest is Dr. Paul Dobransky, psychiatrist, lecturer, and author. He runs the websites menspsychology.com and womenshappiness.com. We'll be right back after this break. Just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Paul Dobransky on the psychology of men and women and as it relates to overwhelming stress and the recent mass shootings. In a past show, we spoke with a Russian scientist, Dr. Kordkov, who measured scientifically the effects of human intention on water, which is a universally sensitive element. And he pointed out that any intention or affirmation, negative or positive, will have profound effects on ourselves and others. And in the context of how you explain what's going on in the thalamus and how pain is received, that's very important. By merely human intention, not even getting to the thought or word part, this is merely intention, it still has an effect on water. There's a lot going on here as far as young people being vulnerable right now to technology around us.
Yeah. You know, one other facet of it that I think is related to that, you know, intentions. What are our intentions? How does that work? I was thinking about the speed of telecommunications and the speed of the internet and the speed of texting and emailing and this sort of thing, and how the cerebral cortex is relatively slow to process things, and how our instinctual centers of the brain and the emotional centers, like the amygdala, for example, it's rapid, and it's got to be rapid. It's designed to save our lives from danger. Well, what does technology do then of this type? Well, there's no natural time lag between an urge or impulse to react, strike back. Somebody insults you and you immediately insult them back, and it escalates to a fist fight, and there we have physical violence. You remember when teachers used to say, take a time out? Well, there's no way to take a time out from the internet. So I was thinking about an idea. I don't know that there's a technical term for it, but you might call it something like moral self-correction. Like somebody has been insulted, gets angry, feels like reacting, but then doesn't. He gets some time, a time out, to think about the ways they could react back, and then decides to do the morally right thing. What if that's a societal resource that's draining away a bit because of the internet and the speed of communication? People's ability to morally self-correct before they do the wrong thing or say the wrong thing.
It does seem very reflexive what's going on in terms of people responding to each other negatively online.
Yeah, just reacting. Yeah.
And the moral self-correction, it is an important concept to begin to apply to this area, given the consequences we're starting to see around us. Because I do think you have a very clear connection between the bullying online and the corrosiveness and
like the milieu that they have to live in, you know, the environment.
It does chip away at them. No one's made out of stone. You can't handle that level of negativity. And what if you're dishing it out? It's going to come your way eventually.
Right, right. That's there was that one recent study of the effects of bullying in a local high school, I believe, on Long Island. And they found 85% of kids are touched by bullying somehow, either by being bullies or being victims of bullies. So it's very pervasive.
When we were going to school, this didn't exist at this level. And I wondered about, well, what's all this news about bullying? Come on, you know, what, people can't take it? What is this, a nanny state? It's an area, it's a frontier. You called it a milieu. This is it. They have to live in this.
Yeah, it's where they're living and learning and growing, right? Surrounded by it.
And we pointed out before, you can unplug from this. However, it can be very difficult because people are very, very emotionally attached to these networks. Do you ever think it will come back to, you know, people throwing away these gadgets and going back to maybe a life that was more face to face with their friends and less constantly monitor, you know, the peer group chatter?
Yeah, well, I think it will, but maybe in ways that we can't even guess yet. It'll be a slow pendulum swing back. People will feel bad about their lives and not know why, and they'll start to wonder, go on a vacation and not take the cell phone and feel like, wow, that was amazing. Right? Start to make a habit of it.
Dr. Paul, you mentioned boundaries a little earlier in the interview, and I just wanted to just make it clear for listeners in that, could you describe psychological trauma in terms of boundaries?
Yeah. Your personal boundary is, it's like a shield around you. It's like a shield against stress. It's a marker of what you control in life from what you don't. It's a marker of what your rights are. Nobody has a right to invade your physical space, to tell you how to think or how to feel or what to do. So it's a marker of your rights, your personhood. And in a lot of ways, it works like the border of a nation. It has all the same functions. It's kind of like a customs and immigration department for who you want to let into your life and how far and who you don't, who you agree with and who you don't agree with. So it's like a shield.
And psychological trauma, you had pointed out, is letting in stress?
Well, psychological trauma is like overwhelming levels of stress that have, you know, invaded your boundary against your will, right? If you had a Customs and Immigration Service, you would have the right to turn people away who are not good people to have in your life. But in the case of trauma, something overwhelming has bust on in anyway. And now it's produced emotional damage. Now, classically, when psychiatrists describe PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder, it requires that there be, you know, either a life-threatening event or the perception of a life-threatening event. So you can certainly see, you know, victims of natural disasters or crime victims potentially suffering from this condition. But there are more and more treatments for it that are effective. It was one of those conditions that they started noticing many, many decades ago. First noticed, I believe, in the American Civil War. And then during World War I, they nicknamed it shell shock. And then ever since then, we worked away in the mental health field to try to decode what is it, what causes it, and what fixes it. So there are a lot of good modern treatments for it.
The stress converts to either hurt or loss. Is that true?
Yeah. If you were to define types of stress, one of the easiest ways of doing that is, you know, stress either comes in to hurt you, or it comes in to take from you, potential loss.
And then the hurt that gets in is called anger.
If somebody hurts you, then the emotional result inside you is now anger.
And the loss is?
If somebody causes you loss, then the emotional result inside you is now anxiety, right? When we lose, if you lose your wallet, you might be a bit anxious about where did I put it? You lost your keys. If you lose your health, you develop a new physical illness, that's a loss of your health that makes you feel anxious. And if you lose a person from your life, it's a massive loss with massive anxiety.
And this is stress, and it's overwhelming because it comes in against your will. And this is all being described in terms of the boundary systems that you have worked on a lot and helped a lot of people on. These wounds can be valuable to some extent in terms of learning from these experiences.
Yeah, I think certainly it doesn't make sense for us to go looking for bad things to happen to us. We can rely on life to take care of that. Enough bad things will come along in our time. But when they do, we have choices for how to view them and what to do about them next. One of the events like this that I think of from time to time to kind of make sense of it all is think about Mothers Against Drunk Driving, right? Two moms lose their teen boys, and at this point, horrible, traumatic loss of your own children. Once you've grieved, you want action, you want to do something, you want to honor their lives and make something good somehow come out of it. And they start an organization that helps millions of people and specifically is related to honoring their children that they lost. So that's an example of taking a horrible, horrible thing, a horrible loss, and transforming it into something that can better the world. And in the process, go through grief yourself.
Getting back to the focus on male psychology and emotional state, I'm not sure it was one of those authors who write about the men's movement mentioned that grieving is very important. Even though a story came out last week titled, "Psychiatry's New Rules Threaten to Turn Grieving into a Sickness." For men, isn't it important, and I've read this, that it's important to grieve. Grieving is the foundation of a wider range of emotions for men. How important is grieving?
I think it's crucial to our health to be able to go through a successful grief process. In fact, the former version of the DSM would define a difference between normal grief and pathological grief.
DSM?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And four.
What is a DSM?
Diagnostic Statistical Manual. It's sort of what psychiatrists use to be able to categorize illness and therefore be able to treat it. But they define normal grief as lasting up to 6 months. And so if something lasted beyond 6 months, it's pathological grief and possibly needs to at least have therapy, if not medication for specific symptoms. So I think what they're talking about there in that article is simply that, where's the dividing line between letting people feel pain or letting people feel bad and withholding treatment that can relieve pain or relieve sadness or anxiety versus treating it. But I think what you're talking about with this, with that author, was that Robert Bly?
I believe so.
Yeah. Well, there may be instinctual value to men to use trauma, grief, major life challenges as a vehicle to finding out what you're made of, if you will. I think it was mythologist and author Joseph Campbell that talked about, you know, the hero's journey, and one segment of that journey being in the wasteland of life, where you're in the desert, and where you don't have any help or assistance or mentoring or friends or resources. And it's there that a hero discovers what he's made of and what he's worth, and couldn't have known quite to that degree of detail without having had the horrible downset in life. And so it's not that you're thankful for the bad times that come, but if they do, when they do, maybe you can sort of put them into context in this way as a challenge to building new skill as a person. So that's why I think one of the things we try to do in these two websites that we have, we found that...
The websites are
Men's Psychology.
MensPsychology.com and Women'sHappiness.com.
Right. And we've noticed that both men and women seem to have a need to discuss these kinds of issues in a gender context. You know, like for a woman to say, you know, I as a woman feel this about this issue, implying that men might generally feel different from that. And so by having their own site, their own website to learn psychology on, you know, there's a lot of comfort in that, being able to talk to each other about psychological principles and issues and this sort of thing. And the same is also true of the men. In fact, even more so, men don't tend to have an overly emotionally descriptive, you know, public presence. They're shy about talking about the emotions generally on average. And so one good thing about the internet, one good thing about the web has been to give men a place to feel safe or comfortable talking about emotional issues. Whereas we might not do so as openly in a crowd of, you know, even male friends, for example. It makes it easier for men to discuss emotions. And we certainly have them.
How important is that? Is it the act of writing them down and exchanging the ideas about men's emotions in a forum?
Well, just the expression is helpful, and just knowing that they're not alone with certain kinds of challenges is really helpful, and for a lot of them, relieving and healing. So a lot of the men will discuss, yes, I had this breakup that I went through, and I broke up, but then I wanted the woman back, and then she wouldn't have me back, and things like this. And then 1,000 other men might write in and say, oh, yeah, I went through that too. And the original man that wrote it says, wow, I thought I was the only one in the world that went through those exact experiences that were so traumatic.
Well, we began the interview with a general focus in on what's going on with men's psychology and what special considerations are given to men in terms of relationships and jobs in this country. Those are problematic areas, as you've pointed out. Ritual initiation is also a problematic area because there does not seem to be healthy initiations for men. Growing up in this country, maybe in North America, there are unhealthy ones such as the military,
fraternity hazings,
things like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It may be hard to believe, but a lot of people point out that men aren't being empowered right now, and there could be a number of reasons for that. What do you attribute that to?
Well, yeah, we can look at the statistics. You know, there are all these, you know, first time ever statistics the past 2 years or so where women are now the majority of the workforce in America, or 2/3 to 3/4 of college graduates. Men shying away from marriage more and more, later age of first marriage. So there are all these major sociological changes going on pretty rapidly in our society right now, and we need to take note of those, and at the same time remember that those are averages of our population, and they don't represent any one specific individual. So the exception to a rule does not make the rule, right? So anytime we read stories about these kinds of statistics, we might get upset or think that, oh, that's a commentary on me as a man or me as a woman, and take offense to it rather than just have a curiosity about it. Why is that happening the way it is? I think part of it is that, first off, you know, for eons, you know, women have been subjugated, and now rightfully they ought to feel empowered, finally, after eons, right? And I think the rise of technology might have something to do with that, because we don't, our bodies don't matter anymore as far as economic power, right? We all can use computers. We don't have to use physical labor as much anymore to make our way in the world. And in eons past, men with larger, more muscular body size were able to take on certain roles and tasks because of that. So now there's computers are the great equalizer economically today. But what's happening at the same time is that our very ancient sets of instincts that are unique to men and that you would probably call masculinity or masculine instincts, and very ancient sets of instincts in women that you would call feminine instincts, those are still here. Those are still in our brains. And they're probably a product of human evolution, and they're not going away anytime soon. So I think that's the source of a lot of the conflict that we have with each other these days between men and women, and why they don't get along so well on a lot of fronts. So what could be done about that? Well, I think it's important to remember that when we empower one group of people, and rightfully so, that doesn't disempower another group of people. So whether it's women's empowerment or men's empowerment, empowerment is good in general.
What about women figuring out how to empower men?
It would be a good thing. The problem is men are also complicit in resisting the very help that they could get, for the reason that instinctually, in general, on average, not for any specific individual, but in general, on average, it can make us feel shame. And that's one thing we haven't talked about. What is shame? A lot of therapists say that shame and guilt are similar words, and they are similar emotions. And one of the easy ways of that I have heard people define it in the past is that guilt is good and shame is bad. Guilt helps us correct our ways and do things better in the future. Shame is always toxic and always does bad things to us. I think maybe an interesting way of looking at the word shame would be to say that it would be a very deeply felt harm to your person that you would feel that is gender specific. In other words, maybe shame feels different for men versus women. Shame as a diminishment of masculinity for men or a diminishment of femininity for women.
Why would it be gender specific?
Because it's such a deep harm that can happen to a person, that it's felt at the identity level, as opposed to just emotionally or just superficially, okay? So what we started with is that men might feel shame receiving help. Now, a lot of people would say, hey, come on, grow up. You have to accept help when it's given to you. And I get that logically. I get that in terms of that is the mature and responsible thing to do. But that's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about instincts, animal instincts in males that we could call masculine instincts, what makes you feel like a man. So these deep-rooted instincts that are part of your sense of personhood as a man drive you to do certain things with a certain style. And they're not a conscious choice. They're not a failing of character, or they're not an ego weakness or anything like this. They're just a reflex. They're built into the average male to not show weakness. Now, some of the evolutionary psychologists out there might talk about how in ancient times, if men were on a hunt and you broke down crying and, you know, were afraid to shoot the animal and this sort of thing for food, you know, then you can't be part of the team that's going to try to find food.
So you don't survive.
So the species wouldn't survive without that instinct in males. So it's not a failing of males for them to have that nature to them. That would be an example of one of the ways where men and women could come together better in understanding each other. For women to understand, oh, wow, that's why men do that thing they do.
Is this discussed in the forums and in
sure.
on your websites, menspsychology.com and Women's Happiness?
Yeah, both of them. Yeah, both men and women will talk about, well, the group of men will talk with each other about it. The group of women will talk to each other. But sometimes we'll sort of have them meet in the middle, have dialogue.
Oh,
have
that must be interesting conversation. What do you do with the transcripts of all of that?
Give them to the participants.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
That sounds great. Dr. Paul Dobransky, author, lecturer, and psychiatrist, who runs the websites menspsychology.com and womenshappiness.com. Thank you once again for being back on In Other News.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for In Other News. Have a wonderful holiday and New Year. We're preempted next week. See you the following week, Monday, 10 p.m.